Hi there, this is Jake from Notch. A quick note about this episode. This was recorded remotely, and the audio quality might not be up to our usual standard, but I really think you'll enjoy this talk with Matt Zabota and Kat Kemsley. Alright, with that out of the way, cue the jingle.
Hi, and welcome to Showcast. It's been just over 2 years since our last episode, and a lot has happened since. Today we're joined by Matt Zabota and Jake Triola. I'm Kat Kemsley, and you're listening to The Notch Showcast. Hey guys, it's so good to be back after 2 short years. I guess since the last Showcast episode, quite a lot has changed. We're still a Notch beta. Notch has indeed grown and acquired some beautiful new faces, one of which is Jake Triola, who joins me here today as the new host. Hi, Jake.
Hey, thanks for having me. Been here about a year and a half, and it's been a great time.
Yeah, and you're also an avid film buff and writer and indie film director, am I right?
Yeah, I have just basically cobbled together a very hodgepodge little career, and Notch has been a great little step in that as well. And I've been really enjoying just kind of making as much stuff as they'll let me, and it's been great so far.
I think one of my favorite snippets I found out about whilst I was stalking you is that you actually moved from a town outside of New York City called Edinburgh to Edinburgh.
Oh yeah, yeah. So that's in that's in my home state of Pennsylvania. I did a little bit of undergrad in Edinburgh, Scotland, and yeah, I think it was founded by a bunch of Scots back in the 1700s. But there's, you know, it's a tiny little cow town right now, little farmland.
Are you Scottish? Do you reckon you got Scottish heritage then, right way back?
I'm not. I mean, I have no idea anything about my heritage like most Americans, but yeah.
And did you ever tip a cow?
I have not gone cow tipping, but I definitely know people who did. Sign stealing was a big one that I also didn't partake in, but that's the one that I more associate.
Crop circles?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, all of
oh,
that.
Oh yeah,
stuff.
Okay.
Yeah. What have you been up to, Kat?
Yeah, I guess plot twist that I'm no longer with Notch. I'm just an official fangirl and I guess special guest segment now. Oh, special guest for today. So in 2021, I kind of embarked on a new chapter and I joined Luke Hall Studio, where I've been part of the production team, creating visuals for live shows, concerts, a lot of gallery installations. So yeah, it's been a really exciting couple of years, and producing some, you know, a load of shows really. It's been quite busy.
What have been the highlights of those shows, like the big ones off the top of your head?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's like a couple of shows that were just really beautiful to be a part of. There's the Pet Shop Boys Dream World Tour, which had been mostly, it was an interesting time to join because there was a lot of shows that had been in pre-production or like early design phase before COVID. And then joining in 2021, like everything had just started up again. So there'd been this big pause in touring, in concerts, and in everything, and a big backlog. So it was picking up again and getting stuff back on the road. So that was really interesting to kind of get thrown into that and, actually go to rehearsals, go on site. So the Pet Shop Boys was cool. We were kind of in the rehearsal studios where, what's that German rock band called? They sing Du hast.
Rammstein.
That's it. Rammstein's rehearsal studios, which was cool. In 2022, I think it was 2022. Yeah. We did the World Cup opening ceremony in Qatar, which was, I think, a really big standout.
Yeah, absolutely.
like show to be on. And
that was one of the first big like things that I showcased that I kind of covered. So that, that was really cool working on that together.
Yeah, we had Sam Lesher doing some beautiful notch work on that and on site with us. It was actually a really small team of us out there making stuff happen and working closely with choreographers and show designers. And yeah, so it was a huge production and just hanging out in a stadium all the time, which was really interesting. And then loads of theatre stuff and loads of beautiful theatre shows. We recently did Free Your Mind with Ez Devlin, and that's going to be airing on the BBC soon. So you'll be able to watch like the full show of that. And I love working, you know, I love dance, and working on dance shows is something I've always wanted to do. So since kind of like some early notch tests where we were testing out a lot of mocap stuff, instead we used a bit of more kind of like point cloud data type stuff on this, but got to integrate that technical side of things, which I really got to learn about via Notch. So it was really nice to see that kind of come full circle as well. Yeah, I guess so. I guess, you know, in with the old, in with the out, out with the in, out with the old, in with the new. But there's one face that hasn't changed at Notch, which is Matt Swoboda, who's also here. Hey, Matt, how's it going?
There's lots of faces who haven't changed at Notch, thank you. Have we really not done this in 2 years?
2.5 years, based on my calculation.
It's gone quite quickly, I think. But yeah, I guess, what have you been up to since we last spoke? And I know a lot has happened, and I mean with Notch 1.0 release and not the Christmas after party.
I think 2 years ago we were talking about working on 1.0, and we are still working on 1.0, but a lot has moved on in the last couple of years. We got into alpha at the beginning of this year, which is very exciting, and then we entered into closed beta in the summer, and now we're ramping up to open beta. So a lot has happened. Find there's real world people using it all the time, and things have progressed a lot in that time very quickly.
So for the first time ever, basically, there are new users actually testing and using the new version in its beta state.
Indeed.
How has that inspired or shifted your thinking? Does finally having outside eyes on 1.0 help? Does it complicate things? Bit of both?
Definitely a bit of both. Everything's theoretical until real people use it, right? But once real people start using it, then you have to actually start looking things down and start responding to requests and fixing things. But that's been a really good process. A lot has developed in the last year just from having real people use it. And also, I think our methodology has changed. Like, we started doing real world user testing, like blind user testing, for the first time ever. And that really helped our development as well. Like, getting people who had never seen the software and putting them in a room and recording them as they try to do things in the software for the first time. I think we've changed our mindset quite a lot in the last year or so.
What have you found from those blind user tests? Anything interesting?
Yeah, the first one was insane. Like, the first one, all of the things that you assume have to be built in knowledge that just aren't true at all. Like, basic things, important things that people just couldn't find. And it's so obvious when you look at it with fresh eyes, and then you are able to make the changes, and suddenly it's like blind, you know, suddenly the blinkers are removed, and you're able to make these really big improvements just from figuring out, you know, if someone can't find something, where do they look? Let's put it there. That kind of thing. We were able to get some really major usability improvements from that just in a very short space of time. And it's a process we're continuing all the time. We're running them regularly now. Become a key part of our development.
I assume that's gotten better and better as it's gone on. I know, like, kind of being on the periphery of, I've heard that as well. Like, we're finally getting into a groove of knowing what to look for.
Yeah, it's the process. You know, for 1.0 was quite a large undertaking because we changed some major underlying things. Like, we changed the whole UI and a lot of the engine as well. And that requires a period of development where you just have to go away and do it before you get to a point that anyone can really touch it. But during that time, you know, you're gonna make assumptions and you're gonna deviate. So you need to really correct those things again. And I think that's what we've done. in the last year. We've really kind of brought things, really focused on usability and bringing things back into the real world. And the user testing and the beta program and the alpha program, all of these things to be really important parts of that.
You use the word usability, and this is kind of something that Kat and I talked a lot about when we were preparing for this. AI has become a huge like buzzword and you know, topic of discussion. Do these trends and shifts affect the way you work?
AI is moving so quickly at the moment. Like it's rapid. In the last year, it's completely changed. So I think things are coming through as kind of fads that get burnt out again, and then things move really quickly. So you have to be quite careful where you place your bets because you can't follow everything. You kind of have to wait and see what actually lands and then where it's relevant. The image generation, I think, is a good example where there was a lot of hype about it. People were suddenly able to just type something in and get a good-looking image. But instantly people are already finding the problems with that, like the holes with that. And there's already, you can see that they have a clearly defined aesthetic and they have a more relevance to some areas than others. And some industries they've really knocked onto. Like, are people ever going to download stock anymore when they can use an image generator, for example? But in other areas, they've kind of gone away a bit and people have, you know, found their weaknesses and they're looking for other things. So if you jumped on every train, you'd constantly been jumping on different trains. You never actually make anything. So you kind of see, you have to take a step back and look and see what's actually relevant and use those things. It takes quite a long time to turn something around into being a viable product.
Do you kind of close yourself off like a monk, I guess? Is that what it takes? Or are you fairly used to the balancing act of kind of paying attention to the world and paying attention to, okay, what exactly do I need to fix in Notch right now? Because I could see that being difficult.
Yeah, we always keep an eye on things. We keep an eye on where things are going, but we have to deal with what we're doing now and then what we might be doing in 6 months to a year. And you kind of have to separate those two things. Like AI is the interesting thing about AI is like, I think AI is really separated in terms of people using it into a few groups. There's like, what do people actually want from AI? There's some people who are really invested in the AI aesthetic as a whole. They love what the creative output actually is. The sort of weird kind of distorted output that you get.
Yeah,
that you get from the image generators. There's a set of people like that. And there's a set of people who just like the immediacy. They like being able to type something in and get a result.
Well, I was thinking with Jake as well. What's interesting about having that is obviously a lot more like remote work and not a lot of studios having remote studios and not being in person or being like an individual freelancer or designer. Basically, you don't often have that person to bounce off of. So sometimes if you're trying to brainstorm ideas or throw stuff about, you've kind of got like a sounding board. You know, you try a few different prompts.
Yeah.
And you've got someone to throw some ideas about with. Well, I say someone, like a machine or at least something to bounce something back and forth.
Like the consenting side, for sure, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But I do think even from the studio or like production side of things, there is like a hesitance not to jump straight on board straight away and throw like your baby out in your bathwater. Mm. Like everyone is, you know, you kind of just wait and see, you know.
Should we get into the AI thing then? Let's get into the AI thing. I think so. Like, if you look at AI covers a really wide range of things. So I think Jake alluded to, like, AI covers everything from DLSS or background removal. You know, like AI, you know, using machine learning as a tool for computer vision, or like using machine learning as part of a rendering equation. Because those things, yeah, you can boil down complex equations into machine learning, it's quicker, it's simpler in some cases. Yeah. All the way up to image generation, video generation. And if you talk about the image generation thing, like, firstly, there's some enormous legality issues right now with image generation. And you kind of wonder, where is that actually a dead end anyway? Are we going to see the current leading image generation things get sued to oblivion and get turned down, and then some new ones come along that are legal? or yeah, at least something like Adobe, which is a much closer basis in legality rather than stuff that is just pure stealing.
I heard OpenAI has been bought by Google as well, so that might totally change everything. It'd probably be put behind a paywall, and then there will be more, I guess.
There's a lot of consolidation. Like, yeah, some of these tools, a lot of the stuff is built on. Like, there's interesting comparison between the results you get from the stable, from noise-based diffusion methods, and just pattern matching stuff from a big database. And basically, the strength of the AI of those tools these days, it's the database. It's all the stuff they've stolen off the internet that makes it work.
Yeah.
So there's some real dodgy legality there. But then you, going beyond that, it's like, what are the use cases? So are you, some people sit on the place of, they're using it to make final image, basically. They want to type something in and get an image out. And that is the image they want to put out or give to their client, whoever. And then you have a full spectrum. Some people are using it, as you described, like a concepting tool. Others are using it as to do certain pieces or to place stock or to generate textures. Mm-hmm. So there's a really wide range of things. And they all have kind of their own like validity and so on. But I think when you get into people using it for final image, that's the thing that's a little dodgy for me. It's like you're basically stealing something from a database and putting it out. And it's a, I think that's enormously challenging. And what I think that's actually affected, you can see clearly see the verticals in the industry that have been pretty much decimated by AI. Like the stocks is an obvious example, but then you talk about it's kind of cutting off the middle, like the low, mid to low end, which a lot of smaller studios actually relied on as like day-to-day work. So it's quite tricky.
Matt, what you said about AI and people relying on AI for the final image really hit home with me as far as my job goes. I do a lot of writing in my job, and I've had friends talk to me about ChatGPT and say, like, you got to get on ChatGPT if you really want to do, you know, a lot of hardcore writing. I'm like, okay, we'll see about that. And it is, it's kind of similar. It's like, if you want to write various kinds of sentences, it can show you many different ways to approach tone or things like that. But it can't like replicate original writing very well and like a certain voice. But what I have found it very useful for is anything as far as like prompting goes. It like write me a description of a storyline or something, but that has nothing to do with voice. And
no, it's good for structurally, isn't
right,
it?
Yeah.
You can do it structurally, but once you've read stuff that AI has written, like once you've tried putting stuff into those tools and you see what the output is, it has such a specific tone of voice, like that you can actually read it when other articles or journals have been written with it. Like, it's so specific.
Yeah,
and I'd say even seeing, you know what I mean?
Like, that's how the imagery is too. Like, you could tell just that for a month or whatever.
Yeah, you could. At the moment, we can definitely tell. I don't know if going forward we'll always be able to tell. But for me, it kind of inspired me to write more personably, to write with more flavor, to like communicate, you know, using, you know, a voice that sounds more like my own rather than anything that's like homogenous or could be, you know, just prompted or, you know.
And firstly, like, model degradation is a thing, right? So as more AI-based generated text and art comes out, the AI is being trained on those. So eventually the model eats itself and it degrades. This has actually already started happening, apparently.
Really?
You know, you think how much material is made in Midjourney or Stable Diffusion on the internet, and if AI is training itself on that, then after a few iterations, you start to degrade quite heavily, same with text. But I mean, I think what you say is true. There's you know, a set of different problems here. Like, if you talk about, obviously AI is here to stay, but what impact does it have on the market? What does it have in the real world? You know, people at the high end, like, you know, some of your, many of our users and, you know, some studios we work with, they're not so much just paid for their output, they're paid for their view, they're paid for their taste.
Mm-hmm.
And they'll continue to be, their taste is that, sometimes what people produce in the real world is very simple. It's a gradient or whatever, but it's people buying into the fact that that's the right gradient.
Yeah.
That's what, yeah, that's the what they're saying. They're selling their body of work and experience and skill and taste that makes them worth that, no matter what, yeah, no matter what the final image, whether it could have been made by AI or not. And they, those people will always, yeah, they will continue to have a great place to be. And I think it's more of a struggle for those lower down on the chain. If you're just starting out, what do you do? You know, where do you go from there? Like, if you just learn to spend for years later, you have to do 3D modeling and texturing, and suddenly you feel like you're a bit invalidated. Yeah. But I think it's still, you know, there's still the difference is taste and style.
Yeah. And that reminds me of that. I don't know if you guys have seen this, but there's just a very short clip of Rick Rubin talking in his studio, and he's saying, like, I don't know how to work. I don't know how to work any musical equipment. Essentially, I'm paid for my intuition. I'm paid for, like, what I've proven so far based on taste, and it's working. And I think that is the kind of invaluable human side.
Yeah.
That will stay, you know, it's stronger than technological innovation, I guess.
And I think it will affect style as well. I think what you'll see in the next couple of years is there will be a move towards people who still work in traditional, I say traditional rendering media and so on, starting to do more stuff that AI doesn't do very well.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, you're going to focus on, maybe there'll be a switch back to really hard 3D, like liney 3D, that's really difficult to see with AI, or a lot of large scale, like things like big particle sequences that are just impractical. You don't really do them with AI, it's just impractical. People will sort of shift their style naturally to say that we're not AI, like make things looking sharp.
Coming back to Notch as well, you know, you kind of think about that barrier to access, or like the usability of something, and you know how AI used to be something which was very much like you had to code to be able to make AI generate something, and now it's anyone can do it. It's something like a Google search bar, basically. And then I guess with Notch as well, you know, initially when you'd made Notch, it was quite specific. It was something which was being used in media servers with like very like high power, super high power machines, and you know, and specifically with people probably with a specialism in live, or maybe with a background with more media servers, which would be a coding background. And I know that when we last spoke, you said like one of the differences between old Notch and new Notch is now that it doesn't just work technically. You don't just get like this, you know, technical outcome, which is real time and brilliant. But you actually, it's like fully designed, like it's a fully designed, like dignified experience, going to be more accessible to every user, not just someone with this, you know, super technical background, mm-hmm. I guess. And if this is the case still, you know, like what's it taking to get there?
I think feedback in talking back about AI as well, like as far as software goes, what does AI do to the software market? Like, one thing it does is it drives people's expectation that things should be easier.
Yeah.
And I think it puts a bit of a line in the market. Stuff like, you know, things are either very, very high-end and particular use case, like Nuke doesn't need to change, and it won't change, right? Nuke is still going to be used for the same kind of very high-end film production stuff that won't be touched by AI for a long time. Yeah. Arguably, things like, you know, Houdini or Unreal—they do, you know, they do have some AI features, but the core of their user base is high-end, very technical. It doesn't necessarily need to change. But as you go through the market, people, there's an expectation now for more accessibility and more immediacy, and to be easier, because that's what they're getting used to. So you have to adapt to that a bit. And I think the idea of 1.0 in the first place, from a UI point of view, was to make it way more accessible, simpler, easier to use. But I think some of the, you know, seeing the AI effect on the market actually encouraged us to make it, you know, to develop features that made it even more accessible. Like, you create a node and we'll hint to you to tell you what to do next, that kind of thing. Like, it needs to be increasingly accessible, and people's expectation is to get to a result faster. That's what AI, for a lot of people, that's what AI is about. It's immediacy. It doesn't necessarily, they don't even necessarily want AI to do it. They want the they just want the result. So you have to find ways to give people the immediate result, whatever that is.
I think that's something Notch has always been prioritizing, is immediacy. Like that might even be, that might even sound very obvious to the people who have listened to this podcast for a while and the people who are kind of Notch veterans now. But does that make sense, Matt? Is that still, do you think, something that people can get from Notch that they can't get other places?
I think it's even more so now. I think one of the big changes in 1.0 has been the introduction of the asset system. So the asset system is we're pre-building blocks of stuff that can be easily reused and shared. And we've built our own library of downloadable assets, which is continuing to be built. And every time someone starts the beta, they're going to see a difference, you know, new sets of stuff. So some of the things we're delivering with that, like we're delivering, but there's the obvious things like materials. We're delivering, we've got a library of materials. So you don't, because immediacy and like instant, you know, this rapidity, it's not just about like real-time rendering is only a small part of that, right? The bigger part is being able to get something done, get to an idea quickly. It's ideation. Like you talk about with AI, it's, can you try a load of things and see which one you like the most in order to take that one forward? That's the that's the new way people make graphics, which in the old way people make graphics was that they thought about what they were going to do and went deeply down the path of engineering a load of stuff and then rendering it and see what it looked like. And then hopefully they got it right. And often getting quite sunk into the cost of doing that. And this has really shifted over the years, but particularly with AI. And we've kind of very much gone down that way too, by providing you the means. Notch always focused on, you know, iterative, being able to edit things live and be able to, you know, change a particle system as it's running to see what it does. Real-time workflow support that. But going further with things like assets, you've got a library of materials you can chuck in to see what they do. You've got a library of lighting rigs. So if you're working on a scene, you can try a bunch of different lighting looks. Like let's chuck a sky in there. Let's chuck a, well, this is parameterized. Let's chuck a studio lighting rig in there. Let's put a load of stuff in there one by one and see how they look and just keep the one you like the most and then work from it. I think it very much follows the same pattern of rapid going through the broad strokes.
I think it's just like a mindset shift a little bit as well, because I noticed that we've been working with a lot of students from various universities in the last year or two, and it's so interesting to see, like, you know, maybe 10 years ago, those foundational tools that they're learning and being taught in school would be, you know, your Adobe Suite, maybe some 3D, maybe some Cinema or Houdini. But now it's really everyone is learning real-time software. That's like the prime thing that they're, you know, or Blender, you know, Blender, Unreal, Unity, you know, like all these real-time. So it's going to just make the mindset of all these new and upcoming designers be very much that is the way that you'll create, that is a part of your creative process, that it's much more hands-on and developing as you can see it in front of you.
I mean, the thing like 10, 15 years ago, like stock content didn't even really exist. Yeah. If you needed a 3D model, you had to go and make it.
Yeah, like now you can scan it on your phone. Isn't that mad? And you can get a decent scan.
But I mean, even then, like, so stock, like, scanning, the 3D model scanning thing, like, there's so much good stock 3D out there already. And there's so much good stock content and materials and everything like that. It's just, like, there's already so much instant access. Like, look at, like, mega scans and all the stuff on TurboScript and everything. It's almost like, yeah, you can scan. I wouldn't personally. I'd just go and get something from stock because it was already cleaned up and it already looks good.
Yeah.
Whereas I don't want to faff around with like cleaning up that scan that's got really dodgy, yeah, really low poly in some weird places and stuff. So already like that is an access thing. Like how many people actually model everything from scratch anymore? That's an art that sadly has been already knocked on the head. And we're just seeing more and more things slowly get knocked on the head.
Most likely you're saying that earlier stage thing, isn't it? Because you would, what we've done is, like, for example, one of the projects we're on is we want to scan, have a model of these two actors. And then the actors change because, you know, they have swings, whatever. And we would scan the act, actors use photogrammetry and then refine the models afterwards. But, you know, you've kind of taken away that initial layer that you would have to work from. It's like taken away, I guess, yeah, just made things more efficient.
Because that used to be quite a little work doing it. And yeah. Now, it's interesting, another impact from this is like, it's now easier to make something realistic than it is to make something abstract.
Yeah.
In some ways, at least from scratch. AI obviously has a different effect on it. But the large, you know, the ability to do things like photogrammetry and large stock libraries that exist mean that producing something photoreal, particularly, yeah, Unreal's so targeted at it as well, you can pull that together just from bits and pieces of the internet. But if you want to do something, if you want to do some 3D in a particularly abstract style, you have to actually build it from scratch. There's much less support. It's a lot more difficult. Whereas in the old days, the abstract used to be the easy thing. Photoreal used to be an unachievable goal. And technology's really affected that. And it probably affects how people pitch content. Like, if you know that it's relatively easy to do a photoreal landscape or something.
Until it starts moving, though, really.
Yeah.
Because then you're moving through all the light passes and everything. That's when stuff gets heavy and you're needing...
Expensive, yeah.
You know. And also what's interesting as well is like you can pre-vis stuff or you can put forward ideas with that look. But often then when it comes to it is that actually that look isn't got the texture or the feel of what you actually... of the final look you need. So it's a bit tricky. It's like a balance as well where maybe you're pre-vising a lot of stuff using something like, you know, an AI or, you know, Unreal, you know, for example, trying to do photoreal. And when it comes to actually making it, you realize, the client realizes like, well, actually, you know, that's not quite the feel we want, or that's not the lighting that we want. And you end up doing these huge, heavy 3D builds, and it's pretty intensive.
And it's chucked out.
Yeah, it gets chucked out, basically. Anyway, probably a tangent, but...
it's interesting, because I went to see the Sphere, went to see U2 at the Sphere recently, and it's interesting like seeing the range of content that was done in that space, all the way from some very heavy, realistic 3D scenes. And some of the most effective material was just text, just bold text. It worked really well. And you kind of, with perspective tricks and so on. And it makes you realize how we can do all in the graphics world, in the sort of the technology world, you can get very into the various techniques and capabilities and the complex rendering things and simulations and so on. And then someone comes on and makes it look just with some text.
Yeah.
And in 2D, and like, there's such a range of things in the real world that get asked for.
But nothing could be ever as beautiful as the real world, could it? I don't know, unless it's like, you know what I mean? If I'm seeing something that has like elements of the real world in it, like Annihilation. Yeah. Like, I thought that was a good kind of reimagining of this hybrid real world where, you know, you've got these looks that feel very real, but they also felt dreamy and bizarre. And then there's that thing of, you know, if you want to make something that looks exactly like the real world, the reality is nothing's going to be as beautiful if you actually went out and had a walk.
Yeah. It's also like often largely pointless, isn't it? It's like you're trying to take people out of the real world, aren't you? So you don't want to put them back in it. As real world content.
I think that's why people love magical realism so much. Like, something grounded in what's familiar and what we know is true. It makes it more interesting when we can relate to it, is really what it all comes down to, I think. You still need magic.
Yeah, you still need magic.
There's a lot of everyday magic that people don't often acknowledge, you know?
Like, real world always has, it's always a tool in terms of like making something more relatable, like, grounding things, grounding the stuff on top of it. So yeah, it's always a useful tool.
Should we come back to some questions, Jay?
Yeah.
We've gone this far without, and we talked about AI.
I'm going to be a real drill sergeant now. So now Kat will embark on a bit of a very high stakes interrogation with you, Matt, about your own words from a few years ago.
Oh.
Take it away, Kat.
So last time you said that beta is a really funny label because, as you put it, is anything ever really finished? But there has to come a point when you say it is finished. And as you come closer and closer to the finish line, have your feelings about this changed? Do you think you'll be able to call it when the time comes?
I think it's the nature of this software is it's just always iterating, right?
Mm.
So it's not that it's finished. It's just that you put out a milestone where it's released and then you start continuing to work on it. Mm-hmm. Like it's constant evolution. This is like, we had a conversation about this internally once. It's easy to think of software development like making an album. Like you make the Beatles go and make the White Album, and then on day one, and everyone's really excited about it, on day one they release it and everyone buys it. It's amazing, and it stays like that forever, and it never changes.
Really?
Like the beat, it remains set in stone as it is forever, and people buy it, and they listen to it, and they love it, and then that's how it goes, right? Software development is not like that. Software development is like, you release something, you build up all this process, and you release it, and then probably at the point you release it, it is the worst it will ever be. And then you constantly iterate and improve on it, based on real world people using it and feeding back and finding things that they want to change, and it molds itself to what people want and it improves steadily, and it should always be iterating, moving.
So I think your Beatles analogy is a really good one to talk about, because as I've interviewed artists and as of, you know, just in life, just experienced hanging around artists, knowing them, like making my own stuff, whether that's music or short films or whatever, like I'm the type of person, I definitely know a lot of people who, once they finish something, actually like wrapping it all up, the whole thing is quote unquote done.
Mm-hmm.
They release it, and that is like the worst day ever for them on the inside. Like does that ring true with you, Matt?
You get like the post-project downer after you put it out. Mm. Yeah, the software is definitely not... Releasing software is not like releasing art. It's just a constant... It has to constantly evolve.
Yeah.
I mean, maybe there was a point like working on like console games back in the in the 2000s where you put a game out on a CD.
Yeah.
And then, or a DVD, and changing it was very, very difficult after that point. So once it went on the DVD, so it was a bit more like releasing art, but software in general, especially nowadays, it's got to be a constant evolution. So you never get that. When the day that Notch 1.0 full release Alta Beta comes out, it will already be weeks behind the bleeding development edge.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll already have the next set of things that are going to go in, because you have staged pipeline of stuff, so we'll already be behind.
I don't know if I'm allowed to say this, but like I feel like when I was chatting to Tom at the Christmas party, he'd said that internally, like 1.0, you'd done over a thousand releases of it.
Yeah, it's a lot. It's hundreds.
You know, hundreds. Yeah. So like, it takes a lot. It's a lot of work, isn't it? And it's such a lot of work going into it, and especially since a lot of the use cases as well, I feel like are often quite novel applications of graphics and design and novel applications, so you kind of got to also have to think quite you got to be quite think in quite a contemporary way as to how people would approach this. Depending on what type of background they've come from, you know, you have lots of different artists using it as well,
because I think there's an interesting like symbiotic relationship between the software and the artist, whereby the artist shapes the software, and to some extent the software shapes the art as well. The software, the limitations, or sometimes the advantages of the software can shape some of the stuff that's made with it. You often see new features come out in media servers or graphics software, and there will be a raft of productions that uses those and does something that previously they were not able to do. They really highlight the strength of software.
Yeah.
And other things go into the software because the artist wants them. So there's this constant rotation of ideas.
You know, now we're moving out of the pandemic kind of high demand for virtual production.
Yeah.
And we're getting a lot more live events happening. You know, what kind of features do you see artists needing more so now?
There was obviously this gap when everything went offline and everything was virtual. Virtual production was really big for a while, but we're definitely seeing return to live being the focus. Most obvious trend is like the size of everything going up massively.
Bigger like, screens.
Bigger screens, higher resolution, more screens, a bigger scale of events. Everything is just getting a lot bigger. Particularly, you know, see some of the productions going on in Saudi Arabia, and things like the Sphere, like these very, very, you know, Altonet in London, very, very high resolution, large scale productions. Are really starting to, you know, they're really heavily starting to dominate the industry, these huge resolutions and so on.
What I thought was amazing as well is, you know, talking about having these big screens and having to produce for big resolutions, obviously it requires a lot of computing power, a lot of render power, you know. And when I was chatting to Will at the Christmas party, he kind of said, actually, a lot of the testing that you've been doing, or whilst the guys are creating looks and notch and internally testing and playing around with things, that they're not using super fast, you know, they're using okay PCs, but they're not using the fastest or like the state-of-the-art kind of computers. They're just kind of using ones which are quite accessible to everyone, which I thought was really cool. And, you know, in terms of making something that it does run real time, looks wise, to have something that, you know, is in theory got this big resolution, you know, accessible.
Yeah, you have to encourage people to, because it's so easy just to get more and more power and then use that as an excuse. Like, it's interesting, just in, you know, obviously 1.0 has been in development for a while, but if you think where GPU hardware was in 2019, 2020 versus now, it's a good multiple of 4 or 5 times in power just in those few years.
A common theme that I noticed talking to people from a multitude of studios this week in London is what you just said, like massive, 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 massive screens, massive output. But their attitude being like, "What? First of all, why does it need to be that massive? And then I guess it doesn't matter because we can do it anyway. It's not a big deal. It's just, it's almost like arbitrary now because you can do basically anything. Like the possibilities are limitless." So people who maybe don't understand that, you know, something is beyond perfect, maybe, is unnecessary because they don't, you know, they don't have their hands on it, but they're still the one who's paying for it, if that makes sense.
Hey.
It's kind of a trend that I started to see when I was working in the film industry, where people had the same discussions around like 16K or, you know, 24K recording, and Netflix or whomever requiring that, like does it matter? Maybe not, but we can do it, so I guess we'll do it for now. Why not?
We've crossed over between where the stuff you can display versus what you can actually make are getting a bit disparate. Like if your show's a 16K res show and it's an hour long, storage required for that is absolutely enormous, and it becomes unwieldy from a content perspective. I'm sure Kat will be more aware of than we are. Like the sheer size and scale of the material that has to be rendered, and just shuttling it around and getting it out, it becomes a logistical problem.
Yeah.
Whereas, you know, you think about this, this has really been driven by massive LED resolutions. Whereas you don't have to go back very long. It's only a few years ago when 4K LED was very, very large. You know, only a bit before that, and the HD res LED was pretty big, and the content's not that big at that point. But when you're talking about 16K, you can't get all of the content on one media server. You can't get drives big enough to put it on the server.
No, exactly. It's the rest of the infrastructure around it, even, you know, having cloud storage and stuff like that.
It's networking. It's all a networking challenge these days. It's all networking infrastructure. It's like, you know, how you get that stuff onto the server just in time to display it, like all streaming off of NAS or something. It's very... And this is where it gets, because how much does the creative affect it by the logistics? is this really necessarily the best idea? Like, what are you paying for that very high-res screen? But from our point of view, it's about, like, you know, for example, Notch running on the Sphere, we were able to run real-time, we were able to run split across the servers. It's very relatively comfortable, but the video content is going to be really, is really problematic.
Could you talk a little bit about the new Notch unified render architecture?
The concept of this comes from the idea that people want a wide range of output targets and different amounts of time being able to spend on each of them. So some people want a real-time output and some people want a really high-quality output and they don't mind how long it takes. I think in reality, most people who are working on video renders, they want a reasonably fast render at quite a high res. So yeah, a second a frame is quite reasonable. A few seconds a frame is quite reasonable. A minute a frame is not reasonable. So particularly when you're in the live environment. So we wanted to provide a set of renderers that differ in their technology, but they look comparable just with different ranges of quality. Basically wanted you to be able to choose your quality and time in a smooth radiated manner. If you've got more time, you can get more quality, but you should be able to linearly ramp that up. So we give you a set of options, a set of different renderers that you can switch between seamlessly anytime just by switching a node. You just hide a node, not hide another node, so it's all seamless. You don't get baked into your choice at all. You can switch at any point. And everything, like the lighting, the materials and everything, works across all of them the same. But what you're seeing is a difference in quality.
It's like quite a big change, isn't it? Because I do remember that being maybe one of the like setbacks that I noticed when it came to being more on site with Notch. You know, a look did have to go from being something that was just playing back in real time to actually being rendered out and delivered as a file. Those renders could take a really long time. Like, you know, and it's kind of taken away from the idea of it, of speed, which everyone likes, you know. But, and then it's, you know, it's a huge innovation, basically, that you've now got this unified render architecture, which gives you options to either react in terms of, do you just need something that is like, can be previewed quite quickly and it can be like an early draft? Mm. Do you need something that's going on these big high resolution screens and being able to choose accordingly? And I assume it's all much faster than previous iterations of Notch, right?
Yeah, much, much faster. Yeah. It's also on the iTools scalability and being able to be split up between machines and that kind of thing. So
yeah,
much more focusing on future sort of determinism and being able to render on multiple machines, that kind of goal. But yeah, it's a really big a big technological change. Everything's kind of completely changed to try and hit this goal. Like, we had to, everything had to be re-architected from the ground up pretty much to be able to achieve this.
So when can we expect to have Notch fully out of beta and available to everyone?
So I can say we are going to open beta sometime in the first quarter of next year is the aim. It's reliant on quite a lot of other factors at the moment. Like there's a new website coming, for example. It's very exciting. And loads of other systematic changes that have to be made that are not necessarily related to the product itself, but they also have to be done in order to get into open beta. So it's not just up to the software dev team.
Your licensing system going to stay the same?
Can't really say.
You can't say. Okay.
Yeah, well, there are some changes. Yeah, there are some changes going. So that will get us into open beta. I think that when we go into full release, that's a wider question. I think that actually depends not so much on the software, but everything around it, like the material that we have to, all the sort of learning material and the samples and all the material we need for marketing that has to go done. It's a marketing deadline.
Yeah.
It's a marketing deadline, absolutely. Not a software deadline.
I'm quite excited for people to see the new website. I'm glad to have seen it myself and kind of worked a little bit on just helping piece it together. I think people will definitely enjoy it.
Good. Looking forward to it.
Do you have any questions as a video producer, Kat? I'm not sure if you had any.
But I think just as a producer, you know, that unified render architecture is going to be huge. I think that's going to be the most, one of the more practical changes. in terms of my anxiety as a producer of always waiting for files to render on time and having to plan for that.
Yeah.
And I think having options and variations and that is, you know, so that's going to be really exciting.
There's some quite good things that we didn't really, like the things that are not obvious that are actually really like important in people's lives. Like it's way easier to work in 2D now and pixels. People want to work in pixels. It's things like that, like the sort of less glamorous things, but actually the usability of things have really improved in that respect.
Great. Okay, well, yeah. Then I'm ready to say goodbye. No, I still got to say a key to the Notch office, so.
What's that? if you do have a keys, can you water the plants down again?
Yeah, I've heard all the plants have died. Substantially.
That's COVID more than anything.
Well, I think that's a wrap. Thanks so much for joining us, Matt. It's been great to speak with you again, and let's not leave it so long next time.
No.
And all the best with the launch. I'm going to be keeping my eyes on it, and thanks so much for having me back.
Thanks for being here with us, Kat.
All right, guys, I'll catch you around.
Thanks for having me. Thank you very much.
Bye.
Cheers. Bye.